The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
You've never met him before?
No, I told you. I just met him in the bar. I never even seen him before.
You sure?
Well, sure, I'm sure.
Of course. Seen a lot of guys like him.
Like what?
Oh, you know. Guys that played it safe during the war. Scrounged around keeping themselves in civvies. Got swell apartments. Swell dames, you know the kind.
I'm not sure that I do. Just what kind?
Oh, you know. Some of them are named Samuels. Some of them got funnier names.
Hey everybody, it's another Loose Cannons podcast coming at ya. You probably are confused as to why Ruben's not talking to you today. It's because he's not here.
He didn't feel like it.
Yeah, he didn't feel like being on this one, so I'm Patrick and I'm taking over for Ruben. Everybody else, introduce yourselves.
Basil is here.
And Ilya is here.
All right, yeah.
In your other ear.
Three of the four original crew here today, and we are going to talk about a film from 1947 called Crossfire, directed by Edward Dmytryk. This is a pick of mine because I did a whole list that was films that were blacklisted, and this film was very heavily scrutinized by the House Un-American Activities Committee back when it came out. But before we talk about this film, let's talk about some of our films that might have been personally blacklisted by us, or maybe not. Some heralds and announcements.
Solo trumpet. All right.
Yep, it's the solo today. Basil?
Solo Bolo Trollo.
What you been watching, Basil?
That was a good question. I'm trying to think whether there's anything that I felt that strongly about. I'll go ahead and herald Waking Life by Richard Linklater. I hadn't seen that movie since it came out in 2001. At the time, I thought it was pretty stupid, or actually the opposite of that, I guess. I thought it was pretentious. That was a thing I was fond of calling movies back then. And now I don't do that anymore, and it's a good movie. I think there's a few parts that it stumbles a little bit in that it's similar to Slacker, and there are parts where it tries to kind of replicate Slacker's more like upsetting and kind of like apocalyptic tone, and those parts feel really out of place in the movie because the rest of the movie is just kind of like a weird sort of meandering, and sometimes I'm nerving like rumination on like death and dreaming, and there's like kinds of fun like puns where, you know, likening dreams in the sort of literal sense to dreams in the figurative sense of, like, you know, dreamers and people who have, like, exciting ideas about the world and things like that. And all that stuff's, like, pretty fun, and there's some kind of cool going back and forth. But then there is, like, some stuff that's like Slacker that just doesn't fit that tone, including, I didn't realize it at the time, but Stephen Green cued me into it. One of the angry talking head people in it is actually none other than Alex Jones himself.
Wow. Oh my god.
Yeah, I guess.
I did not know
Texas
that.
Texas Phenom. Yeah, there's a part where he, like, once he said, "How is Alex Jones?" And I was like, "Alex Jones is in that?" And then I googled it, like, and I was like, "Oh, this is exactly the character I would have guessed." He's like driving around in a car, like, just like screaming about how corrupt and awful the world has become or whatever. And,
that figures.
So that part, not great. But but
I was hoping he was the guy that set himself on fire.
Oh, no, yeah. Yeah, that's another one of the things that feels like it's something more out of Slacker. And I was like, this is a little weird, especially like harking back to that like really upsetting Vietnam photo. I was like, I don't know. I don't know if you earned this, Linklater. But a ton of the other parts are really cool and interesting. And the rotoscoping effect is actually like really jarring and unsettling in a cool way, where like the camera's just bobbling so much that it's like, you know, really distracting, but in a way that I found at first, like, I didn't like it, but then the longer the movie went on, especially there's some cool, like, bird's eye photo shots where it's just, like, going over these houses and the camera's all just, like, wobbling around, and I was like, oh, this is putting me in a cool, like, weird dream headspace. I dig it. And Richard Linklater is at the very end of the movie, and his whole section when he's playing pinball is pretty great. It goes on for a long time, and I liked it a lot.
Cool.
Hooray. Yeah, it's been a very long time since I've seen that movie as well.
Yeah, just filling in the gaps on my Linklater. He's the director I've seen the most things by since I started Letterboxd. I think I've seen 11 of his movies, so.
Wow.
Yeah. That wasn't even on purpose. Like.
So, I didn't have internet for a while, which is why I couldn't take part in some other podcast-related things. But I also had not been able to really watch a lot of things because of that. But the last thing I managed to watch was a documentary called Mummy, Dead, and Dearest. Ooh. And, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's a great movie necessarily, but it's definitely one of the creepiest stories I've ever heard.
I never even heard of this. What is it?
It's about, it's the story of a girl that was like, who ended up like conspiring to kill her mom.
Wow.
Because her mom brought her up to believe that she was like sick and like she couldn't move and she, you know, her stomach wasn't right and her brain wasn't right, and like managed to like, I guess, use that to like get money from, you know, I don't know, various
like disability or whatever
disability. Yeah. Exactly. And it's just like the way it tells the story is it just kind of like veers between like first, like just confronting you with the fact that she, you know, she and her boyfriend like killed her mom, and then it like pulls back and starts talking about, you know, why she did that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty much like a way of like, in a way it ends up kind of being the idea of like, well, yeah, certain type of abuse is like goes so beyond like anything that like even like, I guess, manslaughter in some way is like an acceptable defense, right, against it.
Justifiable homicide.
Yeah, I was kind of afraid at first that the movie would kind of turn out to be like talking about how, oh, look at this woman who like cheated the government out of like disability. Oh, sure. Or whatever, which like to me is always like, you know, like kind of the media likes to make a lot more out of these things than there actually are cases like,
right,
to be relevant. Like now, I don't know if you heard this, but like in Ireland there's a new prime minister who's like gay and a person of color, but who's also like a super conservative,
who's, oh, like, great,
who's like super against reproductive rights and is like apparently trying to like pull in this huge austerity program, and like one of his main points is like, well, welfare queens are like robbing you and robbing us and blah 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 blah, blah. And it's like, and like in Ireland there's been like maybe one or two reported cases of actually somebody like
yeah, it's like a horribly the system impoverished in that way. Country, right?
Like, yeah, yeah, and like there's like there's probably like, you know, tens of thousands of people who depend on this at least, right? And and the cases where people actually, you know, did something fraudulent are like, you can count them on one hand over all these years,
right, yeah.
And but like they're still used for like for political gain. And so like I was kind of afraid that the movie kind of like started off in that direction. I was like, oh, is this really going that way? But it ended up like instead like just kind of exploring this really, you know, pretty sad story of this girl.
That does sound
sad.
It's
an interesting story for sure.
Sad on both counts that
that
incident happened, and that Ireland is buying into that Reagan era welfare queen myth.
While sort of like cosmetically becoming progressive, right? Like, oh, right. We have like a gay person
that's,
of color.
That's the yeah. That's that is the like. I don't know. I forget what you call it. The like neoliberal du jour, you know, thing where it's like progress. You know, these progressive rights. You know, but then like we're still gonna undercut poor people.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we
like,
hate them.
You know. It's like probably the most like obvious case of like very cynical identity politics. Like,
yeah,
like not really.
There, are,
you know,
it's because there are lots
changing
of
anything.
Like, there are lots of rich gay people that are being affected by these laws, but we need to keep those poor people down still.
Yep.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Should Armin White for president? Am I right? 2020.
So finally, Norbit can become like mandatory viewing in schools.
All right. Well, you guys went with the Heralds. I'm gonna go with a denouncement. I watched a movie called Bronson, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn.
Cannon's favorite.
Like, yeah,
Nicholas Winding Refn.
At this point, I feel like he makes movies that are sort of masturbatory and really revel in other people's pain in a way that I don't enjoy. He kind of seems like he's, I don't know, I've been thinking about whether or not he probably thinks that the movie is funny, like the story that he's telling here. And I think that he maybe does, but it's not in a, like, I don't know, like, traditionally constructed sense of, like, it actually being a joke. He just, like, thinks someone getting naked and fighting the police is funny in its own right, and I don't agree. I think that this is a story of a very sad person who has a very sad life, and the movie doesn't feel that way at all. And it seems to be completely unaware that that could be the case, that this person could be, like, extremely sad.
Right.
So it's like a kick-ass story of, like, a badass dude who goes around beating cops up.
Yep. But, yeah. Yeah.
But
just
based
like
on a real fights, person. So.
Yeah, yeah. A real person who just, like, fights the police and has spent,
right,
you know, most of his time in prison in solitary confinement, I think, or something like that. Like, because he's just too violent, and he'll like take people prisoner, and yeah, he's probably gone completely insane at this point because he's spent so much time in solitary confinement, and you know, it's not a movie that's like, I mean, it's anti solitary confinement in the sense that solitary confinement's terrible for people, but it's not like actively campaigning against it. It's not actively campaigning against anything, as far as I can tell. It doesn't have a point of view. It's just like, look at this shit he's doing. Isn't he crazy? Just like,
Refn has zero interest in any kind of systemic anything, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, he has this like really nihilistic joy in just watching like crazy shit go down. You know, he bumps up the shutter speed and turns the music up real loud, and it looks like a music video.
Yeah.
And I don't care for it at all.
The music video of pain.
Yep. The fact that it's based on a real person, too, tells me something
else
about
him.
He
really wishes he could have done that Nine Inch Nails Hurt video himself.
I know.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, he just does not give two doses of a shit about the real person in the story. He's just like, look at how good I can direct. Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like Ruben's snarky joke review of Neon Demon. Relevant again. Can anyone confirm that Nicholas Winding Refn has actually met another person?
Met another person. It's entirely possible he hasn't at this point.
I knew some people back when I worked at the Munich Film Fest that knew him, and like he had been coming there a lot. And who'd say
breaking
that,
news, guys.
That
he has met some people.
Well, yeah, he did. He met them, but like what they said was that he was just like super annoying to talk to. Like he would just be like endlessly like referencing shit all the time when he was talking to people, and like when someone didn't pick up on like a reference that he made, he would like just like roll his eyes and like not talk to that person anymore and like ignore them and then talk to the other person who would then like sometimes pretend that they got his references just so like they could like talk to him.
Yeah.
And I guess, and this was like years ago, this is like when he made that one dumb movie with Mads Mikkelsen, what's its name, Pusher.
Valhalla Rising.
Yeah.
No. Valhalla Rising was later. This was
the Pusher movies.
Pusher. Yeah. Pusher.
Yeah. I didn't know Mads Mikkelsen was in that also.
Yeah, and I met the reason
with blood on your hands.
The reason I talked about it is because he was at the film fest with Valhalla Rising that time, which is also a terrible movie. But Mads Mikkelsen is still cool.
I generally like the actors that he works with, and that's why I'm like, I blame him for this, not these actors, because Mads Mikkelsen, Tom Hardy, Ryan Gosling, I haven't seen Neon Demon, but Elle Fanning, like, I like all of these actors. These are good actors. I just don't like him. Like, his movies are bad.
Yep.
So, yeah. Anyway, getting into people who hate things irrationally, we're getting into Crossfire. This was my pick. So I will give you the plot. It follows the story of these soldiers who were... Well, it doesn't start with them. It starts with somebody being strangled. You don't see who it is. And come to find out, it's a man named Samuels, who is a war veteran. And he was strangled to death by another soldier. We don't know which soldier, though. There's a group of them. And the police detective, played by Robert Young, his name is Finley, is on the case. And he's trying to figure out which one of them strangled the guy. And they think it might be... this one soldier whose name I'm forgetting. What is that guy's name? Is it Floyd? Is Floyd the one that they think might have killed him?
Or is Mitchell.
Mitchell's
the
George
one.
Cooper.
Okay. Yeah, they think Mitchell might have killed him. And they're looking for him. And they question, who are the other two? Montgomery is one of the guys that they question. And Keeley is played by Robert Mitchum. He's the one who's sort of the main... soldier being questioned the whole time. But we see in a flashback that there was a scene in a bar where they ran into Samuels and decided to go back to his house drink. And we find out through the series of flashbacks Mitchell basically coming forward and saying that Montgomery was the guy who was really antagonistic toward Samuels. And we start finding out that Montgomery has some really deep, dark racist hatred of Jewish people, and Samuels was a Jewish man, and eventually it unravels that Montgomery was the one that strangled him because he just didn't like Jewish people. So that's basically the plot. That's basically the whole plot of Crossfire. And then there's Finley gives a long speech about how hatred is bad and shouldn't be racist. So what did you guys think?
I'm pretty in the middle on this movie. For the first, like, two-thirds of it, I felt like I really liked it. Like, Robert Ryan's really unsettling in it. Like, there's some pretty cool photography that's really strange and just, like, I don't know. There's, like, these close-ups on people's faces where they just look real sweaty, and it's all pretty cool. Gloria Graham is pretty fun in, like, a small role. Interesting to see her in a lonely place, and but like as the movie goes on, I mean, I guess like that's always the problem with some of these like Hollywood message movies is that like by the final third, like they can't be subtle about it in the slightest. So there's like, all right, now's the part where we really punch the audience in the face with what we're talking about. And those scenes for me just went on way too long for like me to be like really, really on board with it anymore. Like, it's very cool that in 1947, a movie with like, you know, these actors who, I mean, they weren't as famous yet. They're still like name actors and stuff. And Edward Dmytryk had done a lot of different other movies that were pretty popular. Like, to make a movie that's openly just being like, oh, hey, quit being racist. Like, it's not cool. But also, I mean, I guess part of the heavy-handedness that comes off a little weird to me is the way in which Robert Young's character's, like, big old speech, I mean, we can talk more about this, but is, like, trying to just, like, get an in with the presumed audience. So it's, like, likening it to this other thing that maybe they can relate to more, and I'm always like, I mean, you know, like Irish people had it real bad, but like it's still like a weird thing to be like, oh man, like, but if you hate Jews and you're Irish, then like think back to your heritage, think how you used to be persecuted sometime, and then you'll have a little more empathy. And I was like, I don't know about this.
But then what about the people who've never been persecuted? They'll just continue to be racist.
How do the wasps, how do they relate? Ilya?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like, the movie, you know, the concept of interdependency, you know, the idea of, like, there being different types of discrimination and it being connected, but it being also different in very particular ways would have definitely made the movie's message, you know, more powerful. But I think, like, I would agree with Basil in that I actually, yeah, I liked it pretty well. And I guess to me, the ending, I was kind of not, I mean, I wasn't very surprised that it was pretty heavy-handed in that way.
Right.
But, to me, it felt like, okay, well, I guess, you know, like, what I liked about the movie in the beginning is actually, like, the way everyone spoke, like, very softly. Like, almost, no one almost ever, like, raised their voice in this movie. Like, there are these conversations between all the main characters are just, like, someone says something and then someone repeats that back and then, like, says something else and then they repeat that back, and it's kind of like, you know, and also the acting feels like kind of, I don't know, like naturalistic, I guess, for lack of a better word. Like, it seems like very restrained and like kind of calm and like easygoing. And then like for the end, they decide to like Robert Young, right? Like the main actor who plays Finley, he, who I really liked in this movie. He then like kind of does like the big speech at the camera, right? And then
right.
it all kinds of gets like really huge and big, and he's like filmed in this like expressionist kind of way, in this weird angle with this harsh lighting, and like it's almost like the movie like tries to then like make like this is like the horror that we're like talking about here, you know, like instead of there like being like an abstract cinematic horror, there's this like things within our society, like hatred and so on, hatred of something different and discrimination and racism, that, you know, should be treated as like something evil. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's heavy-handed, but I guess I'm also on board with that. Like, if this is like, in the end, maybe it's, you know, a bit on the nose and whatever, but, you know, I was like, okay, I guess I'm fine with it being on the nose. So nice. I liked it overall.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I liked it also. Yeah, like you said, it's heavy-handed, but it's not, it doesn't ever feel like gross in its heavy-handedness. Like, it feels like it kind of nails what it's going for, where it's like, oh, yeah, we need, I think it's just, it's guilty a little bit of over-explaining a little too much. Like, we kind of get, you know, I don't know, I guess maybe audiences in 1947 weren't as sophisticated, so they did kind of have to, like, spell it out for them. They're like, you know,
I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, like, people tend to underrate, like, previous generation sophistication, but, I mean, I feel like it's more just like that, you know, probably the Hollywood system didn't trust people's level of sophistication.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's what I'm getting at. Maybe that's just like, yeah, like, big studio filmmaking was, it always has been, like, guilty of over-explaining things, I suppose.
Right.
You know,
yeah, I think, but if you look at some certain like texts like written way back like in the 1910s and 20s and 30s, like kind of dealing with like you know, societies changing, transforming, and like people were like up on that. A lot of people were up on that. Like even who you ordinarily maybe wouldn't like suspect of, like, not necessarily academics or whatever, but like regular people like reading up on like socialist or Marxist theory and so on. Like it's pretty I think, like, yeah, I think the point is rather that the way in which that stuff tended to be communicated in films was put a huger magnifying glass.
Let's tell and not show is more of my problem with it, where it's just like, let's just, instead of showing the way that this racism works, let's just have somebody sit down and like talk to the audience and like, you know, let's have a chat, you know, like, and so, I mean, yeah, that's that convention's okay. It's fine. Like, it gets its point across, but it's not, I guess, like, as cinematic as I would have enjoyed. Like, I would have preferred something a little more subtle. And I don't know. I also kind of feel some type of way about the police guy being, like, I don't know, he feels kind of grandfatherly in this. Like, he's kind of, like, holding everybody's hand and being like, well, we need to find this guy. Do you know where he is? And, like, he's kind of soft the whole time. And I kept thinking back to a movie we watched earlier that I'm forgetting the name of now, the one with Sterling Hayden, where he's the, like, really gruff, really mean police detective. Ilya, do you remember the name of that one? I can't remember the name of it now.
I sure do. It's Crime Wave.
Crime Wave. And I kept thinking about how much, like, I like that portrayal of the police chief now, like, or the police detective. Yeah. Like, I was just thinking about, like, because he's so mean throughout the movie, and then when he does do something nice, you're like, oh, wow, that, like, kind of lands a little bit more because, you know, it just feels, like, so out of character in the moment, but then you're like, oh, yeah, I guess he's still, like, almost begrudgingly doing something nice for somebody, And I was like, that reversal means more to me. Whereas this guy's just sort of nice the whole time. And then like, oh, well, of course he's going to have like some, you know, speech where he's like, you know, wagging his finger and being like, you shouldn't be racist. So like, if he'd have been a little bit more of a gruff guy, like a little more hard nosed. But then at the end he comes in with that speech and is like really up on things. I'd have been like, oh, that's really kind of fascinating and an interesting character. Like he kind of, you know, I don't know. I guess it felt more true to me, not necessarily realistic, but just yeah. True in terms of the way that Sterling Hayden portrayed that guy. And the way that this guy comes off is just like, you know, he's just like an angel, you know,
who's on the side of good. My main criticism of this movie would be having to do with the idea that it thinks that although it acknowledges like racism as like a strong force within society, it then decides to also like take the pretty standard route of talking about like bad apples rather than like systemic problems.
Yeah, that as well.
And especially because it's playing in this world of, like, the army and the cops and, like, generally the types of organizations in which, like, this type of stuff, like,
yeah,
usually
it's pretty systemic, yeah. Yeah.
And who encourage it in a lot of ways. For them then to, like, stand there and, like, kind of be, like... There's that... In that whole scene, like, a lot of it felt like rang a little false because it's like, well, why are the all these people, like, Pontius Pilate's over here, like super, like, you know, like that. It feels a bit disingenuous to acknowledge something, but then not acknowledge the fact that, you know, like all these people, you know, in these organizations, they're as much a part of this problem, and this guy Montgomery is not just like an aberration out of nowhere. Like they all carry shit like that with them.
He isn't just so like that racist for the sake of being racist. Like something has fed that racism.
Yeah, and they probably, you know, in some ways, it's almost like they do not really acknowledge their own like role in nurturing and like, you know, forwarding this type of like stuff. Instead, it's like, oh, once we get rid of him, it's like everyone's all good now, you know?
Right.
Like, we just have to get rid of that one stinking racist, and then everything's fine.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that comes down to the Hays Code, of course. Like, that, like, you had to really do some kind of narrative backflips to portray any member of, like, authority, like, politician... military, police, any of those people as like not great, like by the time they were really strictly enforcing it, like you had to say like if there's a police person, that person had to be like doing the right thing, or that had to be like some larger narrative of a bunch of other people doing the right thing, and this is just like that one bad person that they gotta weed out of their otherwise great system. So writers were kind of like trapped in that regard, in that you couldn't have a movie that was like, hey, cops are racist, all of them, the cops, man.
Like, and also, I probably should say this because like I actually talked about this earlier and it's probably important. Like, it is like very particular, like he's an anti-Semite, right? It's not like racism.
Yeah, like,
maybe isn't even the right... The particularly so right
specifically
term
anti-Semitic,
when the police chief kind of rattles off all the like groups that are potentially going to be or are discriminated against or will be discriminated against, he never once mentions black people or
that's
women.
True. Yeah,
so and it's like very this is, like
well yeah
very,
I was gonna say
particular brand that he's talking about,
like, yeah, here. And there's there's an interesting wrinkle to this that I'm looking this up on Wikipedia at the moment, and the original novel that this is based on, the victim was actually gay, so they could not have gay people in the movie at all, so they had to change it to something else to make it about anti-Semitism instead of the guy being gay. So that's another way in which something is erased from the film, like via the motion picture production code.
Yeah, and it's another way in which it like equivocates certain types of discrimination and just, oh, well, let's just make him an anti-Semite then. Homophobic, anti-Semite, racist, what's the difference? All interchangeable.
But I did think that it was interesting, at least like in certain ways, like it does do some interesting stuff with it where it kind of ties bigotry to a kind of like economic disparity or whatever that like part of the thing that's happening is like that, like Robert Ryan has the stereotyped prejudice belief that like Jewish people have means that he doesn't have, and he's like, I served in my country, like I fought in this war, it was not great, like, you know, and now I'm back and I'm poor and look at these other people, like that guy fought, but like how come he has all this money, like we were the same thing. And so like I think that's at least like an interesting kind of commentary. They don't really dig into it as deeply as they could, but
yeah,
I was still like pretty interested in that. And in general, like the beginning of the movie, I was like pretty cool with how subtle it was. Like Robert Ryan's like talking about stuff, and then he just like kind of like throws out these like racial or like, you know, bigoted epithets, but he does it so casually in conversation. The movie doesn't like hit it on the head. It just like lets it sink there that he said that like thing.
It does feel like it's like something that he's used to throwing out, like that he's just like casually does all the time. And so that is actually a pretty good like portrayal,
his performance in general.
I liked his portrayal probably the best, because they kind of get that like casual racism right. And even the way that he says certain things that aren't like specifically racist, but have that like weird like racist twist to them, like when he says the guy's name, so he's like, some of them got names like Samuels and some of them got funnier names, and he's like, it's like, what does that mean exactly, you know? It's like
yeah, I mean, it's pretty smart back that far to like kind of call out dog whistling a little bit, you know.
Yeah That's that was an aspect of the film that I did like.
I would say, as far as this all this goes, I think that this movie, at least in parts, does a better job. Even this is a spacious connection, but I just remembered that Barton Fink, there's like some vague anti-Semitism going on in that movie, but it's always like really on the nose. Like they're like talking about, you know, like hotels that Jewish people can't stay in, and like the pretty clear like between John Goodman and Barton's character, this like kind of very obvious like WASP versus like Jewish whatever like dynamic going on between them. But that movie was made almost 50 years later, and you know,
yeah,
seem to have a less nuanced way to approach it. Although I don't know, I mean, like, I don't know that the Coens are particularly interested in systemic oppression either. So
my alarm's going off, I'm gonna go turn it off.
Dance time. Take a pause from this
short little dance interlude
podcast. But what was I gonna say?
Weird.
I wanted to ask, this is kind of like jumping around, but like, how do people feel about the very end of the movie? Because I feel like that part when the cop just like shoots Robert Ryan in the street was like really grim. Like, I wasn't like, oh, this is exciting justice that like bigot just got killed. I was like, I feel real weird that it's like he's running and then he's like breaks the window and sticks his gun out and is like, pop, pop, pop. And then he just dies in the street. I was like,
yeah,
I don't know how to feel about this. This is real weird.
That did like upset me a little bit, because I was just like, it doesn't really feel like justice is being done. Like, that doesn't feel like the appropriate action for, I mean, like, you know, I still feel like that guy should get a trial, you know, like he should be held accountable instead of just like getting gunned down. It's like, no, like, you know, hold him accountable. Like, you know, it feels like a way out almost, even though the guy's dying, like it for the character anyway, in the like world of the film, I guess. I don't know if that sounds like weird, but it just seems like, oh, now he's just gone. Like, it's right. Like, no. He should be like, you know, they should like, you know, get to explain to him like what he's done is, I mean, he obviously knows murdering someone's wrong, but like why what he believes about people is wrong, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and like I wasn't sure whether or not the audience was supposed to feel good about it, because the way that it's shot, it's so dark, and Robert Ryan like looks pretty scared while he's running around, and they kind of just like shoot him in the back, and I was just like, this is like, you know, I feel like in most movies of this kind, like the real villain, it would be like something where, you know, the classic thing is like, you know, the person's like about to die, but then the hero like rescues them anyway out of virtue, but then like the villain like tries to take advantage of that clemency for a second, and then they kill him anyway. Like, you see that like a ton of movies where like it'll be like a guy catches him, and then the guy's like reaching for a knife and like tries to stab the hero, and then the hero has to let him go, and then he falls and dies, and it's like
the Disney death. What's up?
Yeah, exactly. Or like, you know, they're fighting each other, and then, you know, the hero's got a gun on him, and then the guy, you know, he's got him dead to rights, and he's like not gonna shoot him, but then the villain like reaches for his gun, so he has to shoot him. He
forces his hand.
So like compared to that, like, you know, just shooting Robert Ryan in the back as he runs away seems like it's like a really weird, like, not like, quote unquote, like movie honorable way to kill a person. So like it made me wonder whether that was intentional on Dimitri's part, and if so, like what he was trying to say with that, as opposed to like, you know, doing a more traditional kind of like the hero doesn't want to kill him, but they have to, so
yeah,
this is how it goes.
Yeah, it's almost like the ending is almost like out of a movie that would acknowledge the type of complexity and like the type of like, you know, the role that police and army and so on kind of play in this, like in like enabling, these types of, like, or exhibiting types of behavior that are quite, you know, they're not like the quote-unquote good guys in any case, like, and nor should they be looked at to be good guys. Like, in this case, they managed to find the right person, like, they managed to find the person who did, like, you know, who committed these crimes, but they're not really equipped to deal with this. They're, like, they're just blunt instruments, you know? Right. Like, they can spot something and they can pronounce someone to be a killer, and also they can shoot them. Like, that's what they can do, but they're not capable of really dealing with the actual problem, because in some ways they're not even able to recognize the problem within their own ranks. So like, you know, that you I guess you could argue like the ending actually says some of that, but because it follows on the heels of that scene and everything before, it kind of, it feels like, I don't know, like maybe this was because these movies, you know, I know they were made with a lot of like intent in mind, like lots of different intent, and it was very tough to like get them made, and like probably some things got kind of lost in the making of these movies that was perhaps originally had like much more, even maybe interesting things to say than like the end of the finished movie ended up having, you know?
I was kind of curious, because this was on your blacklist thing, but I didn't actually get around to looking it up. But who involved with this movie was blacklisted?
Edward Dimitri,
the director,
was,
right?
And the director and Adrian Scott, the producer, were both part of the Hollywood Ten. They were they were unfriendly witnesses, and this movie was released like shortly before the hearings started, and it was deemed at the time a controversial film, mm-hmm. because anti-Semitism meant you were a communist, pointing out anti-Semitism meant you were actually having some sort of sympathy for people because they were being racially persecuted meant you were a communist in Hollywood back in the day, I guess. And
that seems especially strange, but I mean, whatever.
Yeah, it's considering this is like right after World War II, and all the things you knew about Nazi Germany at that point, like for this to still be like to make a movie like this that's against discrimination, and for people to consider that to be a bad thing is still mind-boggling to me. Like the way that the whole like Red Scare operated, is it was just right. Like,
and I mean also like you know, I mean
how quickly we forget
speaking or whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And relatively speaking, like I don't know, like. There were a lot of Jewish people, like, in positions of power in Hollywood, so it's like, you know, like, it seems like it could be an easy defense of being like, hey, I'm a Jewish person, I've experienced this, like, thing, I want to make a movie about it, and then you're like, oh, that makes you a communist.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a funny, like, apparently anecdote that Dimitrik talks about when... At a rough cut showing of this movie, uh-huh. one of the like assistant sound cutters like complimented him on the movie and said, "Oh, this is such a fine like suspense movie. Why did you have to bring in all that stuff about anti-Semitism?" And Dimitrik was like, "Well, that was our main reason for making the movie, you know." And the guy's like, but there is no anti-Semitism in the United States. Like, if there were, why is all the money in America controlled by Jewish bankers?
Jesus.
And Vitrix was just like, stared at him and is like, we made the film.
he did the Leonardo DiCaprio squint. He's like...
Yeah, so...
We hated you guys so much. How did you get so rich?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Like, obviously awful, but also pretty funny story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very indicative right there of, like, where people's heads were at. Like, they can see the big evil in the world. They can't look... at themselves and see any of it in them, like they just can't.
But it's also like it's just funny like how message films work sometimes. It's like they sometimes just don't at all, like, yeah. I always like wonder about this with message films. It's like, who exactly like are they usually like made for? Is someone really gonna have their mind changed by watching a movie like this and then realizing like, oh shit, anti-Semitism is a bad thing that's it's right here in the United States. Like, right. I always wonder, like, isn't this like mostly catered to the audience that already kind of knows this stuff, and isn't it because of that like pretty, you know, kind of like has almost no effect?
Probably. Yeah, I mean, I was gonna say, well, just real quick, sorry Patrick, like that even within the movie that is the case. Like, when Robert Young gives that big speech, it's to Robert Mitchum, who is also like a nice guy who's not a bigot. Like,
yeah. See, that was the thing. It's like that speech should have been delivered to Montgomery.
Well, he delivers it to the guy from Tennessee. What's his name?
Oh yeah, that's right.
The kid from Tennessee who's like very impressionable, I guess, and is like kind of easily convinced, and who's like kind of a stand-in in a weird way, kind of a stand-in for the audience. It's like the character is referred to as dumb throughout most of the movie. It's like,
that's us. I forgot about that character. I forgot about him. Like, he like helps them trick him at the end.
That's the writer and producer's idea of what the audience looks like. He's like, these yokels, they mean well, but these people watching our movie, we need to learn them something.
I think like that anecdote kind of tells you all you need to know about how much impact that had,
how it
like,
actually
in terms
works.
Of changing people's minds.
Well, I will say though that I do think that you're right that mostly message films just end up hitting the people that already believe the message. But as a person who has had their mind changed by a movie about something, I will say that there are like some people who are maybe like teetering on the edge or like don't quite get it, and then like a movie will like flip the switch. You know, it can give you that last little nudge into like full understanding.
It depends on what you go to movies for. Like you're a person who cares a lot about movies, so you're like going into it with that mindset already. Like, oh, like you know, you're open to it because at least you know.
But I will say that like, you know, like a dose of understanding can sometimes, you know, like help you fully realize the bigger picture. So I will say that like there is a certain subset of people who are like in that maybe like mid zone where they're not quite there yet, and then they see a movie like this and they like put that last puzzle piece into place and they're like, oh, it's a, you know, it's a boat or whatever, you know.
Just thinking of like someone who's very much more like the sound guy in the anecdote would be like my dad or whatever. Like he's like a real conservative person, and also like becoming increasingly paranoid. He's pretty obsessed right now with like building a bunker, and it was really funny talking to him because he is like he's pretty concerned about impending apocalypse. He wants to have somewhere safe to go. And he saw 10 Cloverfield Lane, and he was like...
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh,
no. He was like, I actually... Like, that movie was pretty fun. Like, I thought it was pretty good. The only thing I really didn't like about it was, like, it kind of makes people who want to build a bunker seem like they're crazy.
Oh, no.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. Yeah, I think it's interesting to talk about like who you're trying to reach, how with what you're saying. You know, like it's. I think that Dmitrik seems like the movie seems to like wear its heart pretty much on its sleeve when it comes to this.
Yeah.
Like it's like. It comes down pretty hard on like this is a huge problem, like people like that, like, and they even says things like, which like, you know, it sounds kind of like simple coming out of like the police chief's mouth, but it's like, you know, that it's a weapon, like hate is a weapon, which like relates to the idea of like hate speech and things like that. So I think it's actually like it's a movie that wouldn't feel too far out of place made today in some way, you know, like it's like has a lot of, maybe it would be like subtler in the way that it would be like delivered, but then like the thing I asked myself when it was that is like, yeah, so this is like 1947 and like we're kind of still making movies that sort of like approach the audiences like kind of similarly, and it's like maybe we do it in slightly subtler ways, but like also people have become so much better at like and media literate that it's just, it almost ends up feeling like the same. Like if you look at something like, I don't know, like even like something like 13th, which I really liked, It's like a movie that sort of like gives you maybe better arguments, but for something that you already agree with, or it's something that like people who like are not receptive to that type of argument just will totally ignore. And like, it's almost like that type of like, you know, delivering of the message is like, hasn't really changed. I don't know if you agree.
I would say in some ways we've actually gotten worse, in the sense that a lot of movies that try to deal with these kinds of issues are almost always period films now. Like Crossfire takes place 1947, right after the war. Like it's when it made, but like a movie that like made this year, Hidden Figures, like that has speeches just as like insultingly on the nose and just like laying it all out for the audience, but it's also couched within this like very obvious, like, you know, way in which the audience can watch that and feel empathy for this character and also disavow any culpability, because they're like, oh man, it was pretty racist back then, look at us in 2017, we nailed it. Like, I'm glad things got better thanks to those fine ladies at NASA.
Yeah,
and like, you know, even when they do like more allegorical things, like, I mean, I would say like Selma's like interesting in the way in which, especially in terms of like voter rights or whatever, like, that it's like, it takes place when it takes place, but it's also commenting, you know, albeit sort of metaphorically and sort of the audience has to do a little bit of the work on like states like Wisconsin and Michigan and other places that are like instituting pretty weird, strict voter ID laws that disproportionately affect like people of color. Like, that's like a thing that is in the movie, but it's not like on the nose. Like it's like about a thing that happened a long time ago, but that is also relevant right now. And I feel like that's like a much more interesting tack to take with this stuff, but obviously, like, the Hidden Figures is a Disney movie they don't give a shit about. They just want to make people feel inspired by strong ladies, you know, standing up for what they wanted, and then
they need a white person to knock the colored bathroom sign down, too.
Yeah. They need allies.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like,
like Kevin Costner.
Like you said, is like even this movie, Crossfire, at least acknowledges like the time in which it is, you know, playing and like, saying,
yeah, this
like,
is a problem.
This is right now. Yeah, and also like especially, you know, talking about something like anti-Semitism right after you had like this endlessly symbolic war against Nazi Germany, whose main thing was anti-Semitism, and then saying like, oh, we have this here right in our society, is actually a pretty radical thing to probably say within the context of the time in which it was made.
I mean, especially that like Robert Ryan is like a soldier or whatever. It's like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Nazis aren't just the people who can hate Jewish people, but sometimes people who killed Nazis also hate Jewish people.
Yes. Like, yeah.
And that's kind of cool. Like,
that is kind of cool.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So, yeah, I don't know. I wonder about this, but whenever like people talk about like fucking like echo chambers and like all this stuff, and how far like movies, you know, can feel like that as well, and like it just like, you know, what type of way which can you send like or transport something much more convincingly to people who would maybe otherwise even not be receptive towards it. I don't know, like, it's maybe not that easy, but like what you mentioned about Selma is like one way, and where you like, oh, you're talking about history, but you're also making people think about like what's going on now through the prism of history.
Like,
I know that Ruben hates that, and like I feel like there's maybe a valid point that he makes about that, where you you know, its specificity of history shouldn't be like, it's kind of like devalues the specificity by saying like, oh, I'm actually making a point about like today. And like you're robbing the moment that you're talking about of some like of its own like very particular history and specific history. So like I guess, you know, that's a valid point. But like there should be some way in which you could talk about the stuff where it's not like just like talking to like preaching to the choir type of, you know, stuff.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't know. Like I think I read an interesting thing, Richard Brody's like end of the year thing for 2016. I mean, he basically just comes out and says like movies are for movie lovers, like it's cinema for cinephiles, like it was a great year for movies if you love movies. And I think that as a film critic who's been around for a really long time, he is getting irritated with the kind of like both Hollywood and not Hollywood, like just like lots of movies in general are kind of reaching for a general audience to try and teach him something. And I think at least in Brody's eyes, like that's not what movies should be for. Like that, I think that art can be a complementary thing, sort of like Patrick is talking about, where there are maybe people in the middle ground, but those people got to the middle ground because of like a bunch of different things influencing how they felt about stuff. I mean, I was like a pretty conservative person growing up, like not by choice. I wasn't like identifying, like, you know, I would have identified myself as like more like, you know, left-leaning, but I knew, but like in my actual like day-to-day how I felt about things, what I felt like I wanted from like government, from society, from whatever, was like pretty conservative. And like the ways in which I was able to change came from like a whole bunch of different sources, like people being rude to me on the internet, people like, reading things, like just like becoming more aware of like outside of myself. Like it was like a bunch of different things, and I wouldn't say that movies didn't contribute to that, because they totally did, but that like, you know, that it's gonna come from like a whole bunch of different places. And I think as soon as we put it on ourselves to be like, art's purpose is not to like necessarily just create a general enrichment of people's lives, but actually to like teach them stuff, then you're like pushing it into this kind of like pedantic thing, because like on the surface that's never what's like gonna actually happen. Like that's like, you know, like this movie, like you were talking about the anecdote or whatever, or like my dad, like he could watch all kinds of movies that have like a sort of like weird, like maybe even slightly leftist bent, and he'll either just gloss over that stuff because he's not looking for that from a movie, or he will like the movie in spite of the things that he didn't think were necessary to it or whatever.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. My
mom or whatever, my mom's got like a real puritanical thing. So like anything sex related in movies, she's like, oh yeah, I really like that movie, but like, why did I have to go and bring sex into it? Like, that's not what I wanted from this movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Boy. I think that's a good point, because also like, the sort of didactic way of talking about certain things through art, it's not the most, probably not the best delivery method of information, right, in that way anyway. Like, it's almost like when the things that like, I think we've talked about a lot here, and like, I don't know, like the way I feel about like how like, for example, Michael Haneke makes movies and so on, mm-hmm, where it's like, it's a very specific way of talking about a particular subject and like making a point about it, and like that, and but like couching it in like cinematic term, you know, right, ways. And like he probably would have been better off just like writing essays or like writing, right, papers on this stuff, and like, and then maybe it would have been pretty obvious like how, you know, some of these theses that are not extremely interesting, you know, but because he's like does that, but then he also does like he's pretty like competent director, it almost feels like there's like something more to it than there actually is, because like he's right. I don't feel like there's like necessarily the art element in his movies is as important as like the teaching moment, and like I agree that the teaching moment should be a very small part. I think there's a place for it in some way. Like, I feel like any movie tries to say something about like whatever relationships or like gender or racism or whatever, I feel like there's a place for that, but like it shouldn't be the be all end all of this movie's existence is to like make that point.
Right. And that, I mean, I think that also like there is a difference between like a person making a movie and being like, here's my experience, this is the thing that I felt, versus like, hey, let me tell you about what it's like to be me. Like,
yeah,
there's like sort of a there's a kind of necessary difference of like expression versus like didacticism, which is like the sort of like, you know, and that I mean, I don't know, I guess, but like I think also part of what Brody seems to be responding to me is like one of my big issues, which is that like obviously the rise of like documentaries as an educative form has become like super huge. Like,
yeah,
people love documentaries, and a lot of people, not Patrick because he likes some good ones, but like, but a lot of people that like almost exclusively watch documentaries, like they're doing it because they're like, it makes them feel good about themselves, like they learned something to watch the movie. And like form doesn't matter in that case, like, and even like journalistic integrity doesn't matter, because a lot of those documentaries are just like making up their stats and stuff like that, like,
yeah,
you know. So it's like a real weird thing where it's like movies are now just like really poorly conceived like visual newspaper articles, and yeah, I think that's like a garbage thing for movies to try to be.
Yeah, and then you can also start getting into like the people who make really terrible documentaries that are like doing basically the same thing, like making up stats, but they're making it up in the opposite direction, and so you're just like, it's like, you know, who's to be believed here? Like, you're both making things up about this.
Right.
And
yeah, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that I find so upsetting about Michael Moore, is that he gives like in his own way, where he is like disregarding actual facts to try and make whatever point that he wants to make, he is legitimizing people like Rush Limbaugh's existence, because they do the same thing, they just happen to be right wing as opposed to left wing.
Yeah.
And if like a bunch of left wing people are like, yay Michael Moore, then you can't be mad at right wing people who are like, yay Rush Limbaugh, because they're
or
like doing the
Dinesh
exact same
D'Souza
thing.
Or somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, those are garbage people. Like, and Michael Moore, for sure, at least his heart is in the right place. Like, he really wants the world to be better and, like, care about other people more, which obviously Rush Limbaugh doesn't give a shit about.
Yeah.
But it's still, like, when you, I don't know, I mean, like, this is some of the things with, like, this is totally a tangent at this point, but there was a rally in Portland yesterday that was like a free speech rally that was like a bunch of alt-right people got together, and the mayor, because of like what happened in Portland, like with people getting stabbed recently, they died, it's terrible, like everyone's like upset in the city. And the mayor tried to petition the U.S. government to cancel the rally because, like, I guess whatever square they had done it in was, like, technically federal land, not state land. So, so he had to get the U.S. government on board. And the ACLU came out and was like, don't do that. Like, because even if your heart is in the right place, like, these are people with hate speech, whatever. Like, if as soon as you petition the government to like shut down legal rallies because you disagree with their ideology, like, then that sets a precedent that doesn't go away. And in the future, like, you know, when we get like weirdo fascists and momentarily in power, they can like go to this and be like, hey, like, there's a precedent here. We don't like these people who are like against what we're about, so we're just gonna shut you down right now. So
yeah,
it's,
I mean,
like a weird thing where, like, you know, like Michael Moore being like, it's okay if I bend the facts because in the end I'm right, like people need to be better and help each other more and like care about the fact that people get shot all the time or people don't have health care or whatever, like, but as soon as you start down that path, it just gives ammunition for people who do not give a shit about helping people. Like,
that's true. I feel like in this particular example that you mentioned, I like that we're on a tangent. I think we can
get this
back to Crossfire at some point, but like to that point, I think there's also an argument to be made for the idea that in some ways certain types of like rallies and demonstrations and so on and so forth have like historically been more okay to be held than like others. And like there's been like, although like maybe in theory that should be, you know, all equal, but it's not. And so the fact that like you'd want to step outside like the framework which we've kind of allotted for these types of things and say, well, actually these people don't deserve to say the shit that they're saying. And although, yeah, that might set a precedent, in a way you could almost say like there's been a precedent already set, but it's been set the other way around where you've like had people being denied spaces and places to talk about things and so on and so forth. And like, this is just a way to resist the idea that we should be dependent on the government for these types of like issuing these types of spaces in the first place, where you could just say like, you know what, fuck that, like, just like, and so like maybe if you, I don't know how exactly to, I think you know what I mean, like if you would take that and transport it into like cinematic terms, I'm not sure what the equivalent would be, but I like, I understand that the idea, the desire to say like, you know, beyond just saying that these are like false equivalencies with like Moore and like Limbaugh and so on, but to say that like, there's a reason why people like Moore do their thing and that's like, it's okay, but there should probably... there should probably be a way to still prevent guys like Limbaugh and D'Souza and so on from like making the shit that they're making, because it, in the end, it's like it shouldn't have the same they shouldn't have the same freedom to express the shit that they express, because it's
right. I mean, like, but like, it's all kind of like an interesting sort of, I guess, like slippery. I mean, the slippery slope argument actually, I feel like, kind of does apply here in the sense that, like, you know, I mean, not all of them, like Rush Limbaugh for sure, but people like my dad who actually like listen to that stuff and watch fucking Fox News, he believes he's right. Like, he believes in his core that, like, you know, he is doing the right thing if like those types of policies were more enacted. And that, like, you know, I mean, there's like a bunch of people who are just like cynical people exploiting that or whatever, but it's like, it is kind of a thing where it's like the problem with like being like, we're right and these people are wrong, so we can't let these people do what they're doing because they're obviously wrong, is that if there ever was a shift, like, along down the line, then it does create a kind of precedent for suppression, where it's like, oh, it was okay when you did it and you thought you were right, but we're pretty sure we're right right now.
Yeah.
And you're wrong, so, like, you can't say what you're saying. And it's, like, a weird thing. But, I mean, like, in the case of this, like, all the anti-fascist, like, counter-protesters that showed up yesterday, they were all posting on social media being like, fuck the state, don't get them involved. We're going to show up and yell at these Nazis, and, you know, that's what we're going to do. And that's what we think you should do, too. Like, don't cancel their rally. Just show up and overwhelm them. Show them they're not welcome.
That's probably a better course of action, to be honest.
Too bad the police suck, because...
There again, like, you know, the state may have a different idea about what's right and what's wrong, and then if you give the state the power to, you know, suppress anything, then they may start suppressing the things that are good, and it's we know that the state is pretty inflexible in a lot of things. Judging by the state, judging by exactly what happened with the, you know, Edward Dimitrik and Adrian Scott following the release of this film, like, they were like, you're a communist, like, we're going to get you. And so it's like, you know what? Like, if you believe that communism is bad, like, and then they're going to suppress it. And it's like, you can't like sit down and have a discussion with the United States to be like, hey, communism's not bad, guys. It's just a political viewpoint.
I think there's also like a point to be made for, like, you know, saying, like, in the way that, like I understand the reason why, like, language, like, needs to be very, like there should be very strict rules for, like, certain types of language. Like, I understand that. But also, like, whenever, like, even with this, like, Bill Maher shit that, like, happened, that, like, to me, the kind of disingenuous thing about it is that, like guys like him, you know, I don't give a shit what happens to him. Like, even if he's fired, like, who cares? He's still going to be, like, a fucking millionaire after this. Like, nothing will, like, it's not going to, like... not going to change at all. But then we can all, like, sit there and feel better because, like, oh, someone said, like, a racial slur and we sure fired him, you know, we sure showed him. And, like that to me seems like also, like, a very, like, knee-jerk, like, type of, like, gratification for on, like, a level, like, on a society level where we all get to feel better about ourselves for, like, banning this. And, like, in that sense, I agree that, like, taking away, taking away those people's right, I guess, to, like, go out there and say heinous shit would also feel like, oh, well, we sure showed those, like, fucking 200 morons, like, that they have no place in this, in our society. And, like, well, really, like, what are you really, like, is that really... the main thrust of what you should be doing, or should you be tackling something much more difficult and complex, and, like, you know, and, like, these 200 assholes that will stand out there and shout, you know, I guess, you know, they're in a way just a symptom of what's already been happening for a long time, and just like taking them out of the picture feels almost as disingenuous as just, like, saying, oh, well, We fired Bill Maher, so we're like a progressive society, you know? This fucking idiot who's been racist on TV for 20 years.
You supported him for 20 years, but now, oh, because he said something, he said the magic word or whatever, like, we have to fire you, you said the magic word. It's like, well, the dog whistles have been there, like, you know, he's been transphobic on TV, and he's, you know, like, all these other things, and it's just like... You didn't have a problem with him then. He was a bastion of, you know, progressive media or whatever. And now all of a sudden, oh, you have to fire him over that. It's like, well, you didn't see, you weren't reading between the lines before. Like, you were missing something there.
Just to be clear, though, still fire him. because fuck that guy.
Oh, yeah. Fire him. Like, a long time ago, fire this guy.
With all I said, still, totally, please fucking fire this guy.
Fire him. Right. For fuck's sake.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, all of it's, like, built on, like, obvious hypocrisy or whatever. I mean, like, this is, again, another tangent, but the whole Kathy Griffin thing or whatever.
Yeah.
It's such garbage. Like, everyone is fine with, like, talking about Trump dying. Like, nobody gives a shit.
No one gives a shit, yeah.
And, like, yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that I saw that was obvious, like, is, like, you know, Ted Nugent in an interview said that if, in 2012, if Obama was reelected, he's probably going to go to prison because he's going to murder Obama. Like, he said that in an interview. Yeah. And then, like, very recently, Ted Nugent, guest of the White House, hanging out with Trump. Like, obviously, those people don't care about the sanctity of the presidency or whatever.
That's partisan shit.
Yeah, but, like...
But yeah, to bring it back to Crossfire, sort of what Ilya was saying was that, you know, there are these smaller things that we get upset about without addressing the larger systemic issue. And as we were saying about Crossfire earlier, it's attacking a very specific subset of racism where there's a larger systemic issue that needs to be addressed. It's not being addressed by this film. It's just very specifically saying, oh, this one guy's bad, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, and you know, this is how people like him get bad, but it's like a vague thing of just like, you know,
we won't let people into country clubs.
And then also like, you know, like that as, I mean, again, probably not Dimitri's fault. We can't blame him or the producers or whatever, but that this movie is obviously engaging in its own form of like hateful erasure where it's like no black people exist in this movie. And also like when we talk about bigotry, we're not going to mention black people even though they are clearly like,
and you know, also the fact that the original source material has a gay character instead of a Jewish character. And so it's actually about something completely different originally, but you know, again, erasure of the system. It's like you can't talk about that at all. Like, can't even mention it.
Yeah, I
and
think
even
like
if you've read the novel, like it's like probably a little insulting to watch the movie because they go also pretty out of their way to make it clear Samuels is not gay. Like he's like hanging out.
Oh
with
they add a character in there. Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, it's like it wouldn't, because like, you know, you could still have that subtext if it was just like a bunch of those guys hanging out together and then they all kind of go back to his apartment.
Yep.
But like as soon as you add that female character who is like, you know, then the whole dynamic shifts and there's not even the possibility of like the original source material getting through in a subtextual way.
And that's, that's, for a while there I was afraid that they're going to make Robert Ryan like a closeted person who then like lashes out and kills him.
I kind of got that from like Samuel's character, like his interactions with it's Mitchell that he's talking to, right? Like he and Mitchell are talking. And I was like, these guys kind of have like a tender conversation where they're like really like sympathizing with each other or like empathizing with each other about the war and stuff like that. And I was like, these characters are like really connecting on a, you know, and obviously like it's never more explicit than that, but it's like, these characters, you know, I could see that where that, the like gay subtext was coming in to the story itself.
But also, I read an interview with Foucault recently that was just about like gay relationships and the ways in which that they're radical. And I feel like the idea, I mean, like this is a little bit what he's talking about, is like they're radical because of like the way they generate like unallowable male friendships, like that society, socially, like they're forging these new relationships that we don't let people have, that like from a, like he was kind of talking about gay men versus like gay women, and that in some ways like women have been allotted these spaces where they can be together and do pretty intimate things, and it doesn't necessarily have a sexual connotation, but that for a minute always does. And like, so I agree that that subtext could be there, but in a way that's also kind of sad, because that means that like anytime we see two men having like a fairly intimate bonding conversation, we're like, oh, they're probably gonna do it later. Like,
yeah, that is true. Another system, yeah, thing. You know,
yeah, wow. Again, it's like, it's just the way in which, you know, men are socialized.
In a way,
it sucks, but
isn't that like, yeah, kind of the same like argument that like Louis C.K. makes when he talks about like like, I just want to like a guy who like I can like, you know, who can hold me, oh, yeah, and like blah 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 blah, like it's,
yeah,
basically,
yeah, he
this
wants a boyfriend, but he doesn't want,
yeah,
to
but
have sex with
doesn't
him.
Want to have sex with him. Yeah, it's basically the same.
Right on.
Like, he probably read Foucault.
When I'm cold,
yeah, exactly. I'm, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think my mate, like, just to bring it back, maybe I don't know. Bring it back to that, just for a second, just like to end, maybe like to end my thing on that. The bad apples argument for me, like the most destructive thing about the like, oh, it's just this guy and like. Once, you know, is that it does not acknowledge the potential to for in everyone to be that guy.
Yeah. Right.
It's,
yeah,
like,
that's true.
If you just think of racism in terms of it's that person who's racist, or it's and they're like usually like a demonic evil presence or whatever, mm-hmm, you'd never acknowledge the potential that like everyone has to act in a way that is pretty, that is racist or is homophobic or whatever else. And so as long as you make that argument, you never admit, like you never acknowledge the things that you might be doing that are sort of similar or whatever. And I think like that's the most destructive element of it. And because the sort of racism argument has been framed in that way for so long, it's been almost impossible to bring it back to the idea of like, well, no, like you can be that too, because it's so much like, no, it's this evil guy who really is racist, not me, you right. know, like
yeah,
to me that's the most dangerous part of it.
I mean, obviously that's one of the things that's most radical and amazing about Do the Right Thing, is that like from a lot of white audience watching that movie, they're probably gonna identify with Sal,
with Daddy Yellow,
like,
yeah,
you know, yeah. And so like there, you know, and that there are different gradations of racism within the movie that had then even a little bit like encourage that association, because he's got his like racist son and like other different like racist people, and like as a white liberal, like, you know, think of themselves as not racist viewer, they can be,
yeah,
like, well, you know, like fuck that son, fuck that other guy, like, you know, I'm a nice guy, I'm like Sal, like, you know,
yeah.
And then, but then when he gets pushed, when he gets upset, he screams, he yells, he drops the N-word, and you know, that's all out the,
yeah,
window. Cause,
and the sad irony of it was that a lot of white audiences, when they watched that movie, they were still on his side when the movie ended. They,
yeah,
were like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Well,
like, oh, they
pushed him. They pushed,
yeah,
him.
They were like, he shouldn't,
like,
have destroyed
a lot of people were like, yeah,
that window.
Yeah.
Yeah. Destruction of property, the worst thing that could happen.
I
in
know, right?
A white person's mind.
Oh no, the CVS. Think of the CVSs.
Sal's Pizzeria. How's he gonna make pizza? He's helping out the community.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. God.
What a good movie.
Yeah, it's really awesome. And it's also very, I mean, but like, even the fact that it, all that shit goes over people's head is like part of the point of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, that's,
absolutely.
That's part of what,
yeah,
makes it. Like,
and the fact, like, that Spike Lee doesn't
so
give a
smart.
Shit that it goes over people's heads, like, so what? So then it does. That's exactly, like you,
yeah,
said, it's part of the point.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, in some,
well,
ways, like,
that's what I was saying. Yeah.
Right. He refuses to do it. Like, you know, I mean, he's mentioned in interviews multiple times that the only people who ever come up to him and ask him whether or not like Sal did, I mean, not Sal, but Mookie did the right thing, are white people. Like, black people never ask that question. And that, like, you know, Spike Lee doesn't answer them. Like, he's not going to be like, no, idiot. Like, you know, he's like, this person saw my movie and doesn't know whether or not Mookie did the right thing. So what am I going to do? Like, I made the movie. They can't figure it out. Like, I'm not going to explain it to them.
Yeah, I think he makes it like
for them. Yeah.
I think I told you this story before, but I remember when I watched Do the Right Thing with some friends of mine in Berlin, right? Like, this was like 10 years ago or whatever at this point. But like, we had finished the movie and then it showed the MLK quote. Mm-hmm. And the my friend of mine I was watching it with, he just like groaned, was like, ugh. Like, ugh, so this is what it was about. And then like, and I'm just like waiting. I hadn't watched the movie yet, but I'm like, wait, just wait. And then like after that, the Malcolm X quote shows up and I'm like, yeah, see, fuck you, moron. Like, it's not didactic. It's not, oh
yeah,
this is a parable about how actually violence should be, or resistance should be peaceful. Like, right. That's not what it's about at all. And that, like, it exists within the two, you know, within the two like ways of framing and shaping that argument. Yeah, I think that's a very like that movie actually uses, like, it plays with didacticism really interestingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a super smart dude. I wish he could get money to make something like that again. I mean,
yeah.
Pretty sweet, but it's a lot messier of a movie.
I wish the end game of Chirac hadn't been pull your pants up, but
yeah.
Yeah, no, I wish there were just like more directors that were inspired by that movie than a lot of other movies that directors have been inspired by.
Yeah.
Yeah, or in the wrong ways, like people thing for, like, you know, like, directors who love that movie love it for the same reason they love, like, Lawrence of Arabia. Ooh, what craft, what energy.
Yeah.
Colors. Right, yeah. Formalism.
What form.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's why that movie's so good. It's because of all the fucking great camera moves that are in there. And the fact that Spike Lee wrote it in, like, 2 weeks. That's, like, the most amazing part of it. Sure.
I wrote my movie in 1 week. Suck it, Spike Lee.
Boom. Yeah.
My movie's going to be twice as good as yours.
And I'm going to tackle racism and homophobia. Boom.
This is totally, I'm bringing it back to the movie, but for something completely unrelated, which is there's a part in the movie where, they have to hide Mitchell out, and they hide him out in like a 24-hour movie house.
Oh, yeah.
And A, I wish those still existed.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And B,
yeah,
I would be super mad if I was in that 24-hour movie house because they're just having a conversation.
Yeah.
Be like, fuck you guys, I'm trying to watch this movie. You guys are talking about hiding out like from the cops.
Murder or whatever you're talking about back there. I don't care if he did the murder. Go talk about it in the lobby.
That's true. I'm trying to watch Gone with the Wind at midnight.
Or whatever,
I have weird shifts at work.
Oh, man.
I need to get my movies watching on.
I would love a 24-hour movie house. That would be so amazing.
That'd be really cool.
Oh.
I mean, the best that I ever had in any city was, for some reason, when I lived in Atlanta briefly, there was this one movie theater that had, like, screenings that started between 12:30 and like 1:30 a.m. like every day, like every single day of the week they had them. And I was like, I never even heard of this before. And my girlfriend at the time, she was working like as a nurse 12 hours a day, and she would get off at like 11 p.m. so by the time she got home it was like 11:30. Just like take a shower, grab something to eat real quick, and then go to a real late night movie. It was pretty fun.
That is pretty
good
fun.
Good times.
But Portland doesn't have anything like that. Portland hates staying up late.
Yep. LA does too, apparently. Where bars close at
Yeah, it's real weird. I heard they're trying to change the bar laws, though, so they can stay open until 4.
Yeah, that's... Hopefully that gets passed. They probably will.
Yeah.
We're pretty good about passing recreational shit.
Yep.
Recreational ordinances.
About time. No such restrictions in Berlin.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I 24 hours. Got into Bergen, right?
Everywhere, yeah, yeah. How was it? Did you like it?
He did like it.
Yeah, that's they actually they did a like this is weird tangenting way the hell out now but Berghain once did a showing like they for like a couple of days they had a play of After Hours playing there at Berghain and they had someone actually do like a whole like run of a play at Berghain. It was just like awesome to me. Like,
yeah.
Wait.
So the kind of people who run that place, they're really what, like,
so.
I mean, they're also like
of After Hours, the like the Martin Scorsese film After Hours, or was you were just saying it was after? Okay, okay.
Yes,
that's what I thought you were saying. But then I thought I was like, oh, he might also.
It was just be After Hours, was after but hours also this club is open like 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
From, so like, no Friday to Monday.
Right.
So, there you go.
Except for the Martin Scorsese film. Yeah. Awesome.
I mean, yeah.
That's a good film.
Yeah.
Sure is. Right.
All right.
So.
Does anyone else have anything else to say about Crossfire? It's been about an hour since
I think we said it all. I think we nailed it.
Talked about it.
I think we talked a lot about other stuff that was like inspired by this movie, but I think that's okay.
Yeah, that was maybe my favorite thing of this whole episode. Is it was just like a jumping off point to all this other shit that's happening. So I think I like this movie a little bit more now.
Yeah.
It's inspired some pretty good conversation.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. I listened to this for the tangents anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
this is the best. All right.
I was gonna say, real quickly, that I've been thinking on that note. Like, I've been thinking about raising my score of Patterson slightly, just because it's been generating some pretty cool, awesome conversation on Letterboxd, which hasn't been happening that often with me. So I'm like, maybe I like this movie more now, just because of the cool talks I got to have about it.
Mm. Right on.
That is pretty cool. Yeah, well, I saw the comment in your letterbox. Yeah, it was pretty interesting stuff.
If you also enjoy our tangents or our on-topic discussions, you can rate and review us on iTunes. Give us 5 stars. Give us a comment. Or you can find us over at our message boards. That's loosecannonspodcast.boards.net. You can find us there. You can find us at loosecannons.net. That's cannons like canonical, not like the gun. And
we're anti-gun violence on this podcast.
Subscribe on your podcast listening application of choice. And what do we have up next? Do you remember which movie?
Always Shine.
Always Shine from 2016, directed by what was the
Sofia Takal.
Sofia Takal. That was from Ruben's Sofia Takal list. And we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye.